Thank you very much.
Mr. Trump,
President, you just used the word bedlam. Will you tell your supporters now, no matter what, no violence?
No, he will not. So I guess that means yes, violence?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. Mm-hmm. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Seattle's KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast, where we are still sort of dancing between keeping up and catching up, Desi Doyen, following our longer than expected due to COVID holiday break.
Yes, and there's so much to catch up on and so much still happening.
What? There is?
Go figure.
As many are, I know, racing now to see accountability for Donald Trump before this year's presidential election, perhaps even before this year's nominating convention in July, I believe it is. In fact, accountability, in truth, even in the best of circumstances, and these are not the best of circumstances,
nope,
takes time, whether we like it or not. That said, there has been a series of accountability stories sort of leading up to, during, and since the holiday break for a whole bunch of right-wingers and right-wing organizations that I sort of want to try to begin to get caught up on today, make sure that you know about today, even as some happened while we were out. I will get to those in a bit. Also, for some reason, on tomorrow's Bradcast, I understand, we will have full Bradcast team coverage. Is that right?
Yes,
Of CNN's Wednesday night two-person 2024 GOP presidential debate in Iowa in advance of next Monday's Iowa caucuses. Those two people do not include the two front runners or the presumed front runners. Instead, Donald Trump will not be there once again. It will only include Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. Happily, I believe it will only be 90 minutes or so.
Oh, good. And we won't have Vivek Ramaswamy to kick around anymore.
Oh, well, then I say we cancel team coverage. we will, for some reason, have special coverage on our next Bradcast. So there is that. But first today, on Tuesday, as discussed at the bottom of yesterday's show, because frankly, that's the placement it deserved, the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C. held a hearing on Donald Trump's absurd, absolute presidential immunity claim, wherein the disgraced former president and four-time criminal indictee argued that it is unconstitutional for a president to be criminally prosecuted for any crimes committed while serving as president. The argument, of course, is little more than a transparent effort to delay his March 4 trial date and his federal indictment related to his many efforts to steal the 2020 presidential election until after the 2024 presidential election, which he hopes to win and then use to make all of his federal crimes simply go away. After the hearing, Trump held not a press conference, as some described it. He took no questions from the press, but he gave an on-camera statement to the media at his old D.C. hotel, threatening the nation pretty directly if his pretend case for immunity was not accepted and his criminal trial moved forward in advance of this year's election. The Washington Post reported the remarks this way. Headline, Trump warns of, quote, bedlam, declines to rule out violence after court hearing. I might have said that Trump threatens bedlam, but for the Washington Post, close enough, particularly given their lead on the story. Quote, Republican polling leader Donald Trump on Tuesday threatened unrest if the criminal charges against him cause him to lose the 2024 election. Speaking to reporters after an appeals court hearing in which Trump's lawyers said he should be immune from prosecution for trying to overturn the 2020 election, Trump claimed without evidence that he was being prosecuted because of polls showing him leading President Biden. He warned that if the charges succeed in damaging his candidacy, the result would be, quote, bedlam. Quote, I think they feel this is the way they're going to try and win, and that's not the way it goes, Trump said. It'll be bedlam in the country. It's a very bad thing. It's a very bad precedent. As we said, it's the opening of a Pandora's box. The former president did not take any questions, as the Post noted, and walked away as Post reporters asked him to rule out violence by his supporters. Trump's comments came 3 days after the third anniversary of his supporters' attack on the U.S. Capitol, inspired by Trump's false insistence that the 2020 election was stolen. Over the years, the Post notes, Trump has increasingly defended the riot and embraced people charged in the attack. On Saturday, he called them, quote, hostages, and demanded their release. His repeated evasions of ruling out political violence came amid a rising menace of threats and attacks throughout American politics. But on Friday, Joe Biden condemned Donald Trump for refusing to reject violence. Not a bad lead headline or a bad lead, both of which seem to get right to the point and tell the truth about Donald Trump threatening the nation, threatening violence, if the criminal charges he is facing do not go his way. By contrast, last week, as the nation was preparing to mark the grim third anniversary of the deadly Trump-incited insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, and we know he incited it and that it was an insurrection because both courts and bipartisan majorities of both houses of Congress have officially determined as much. Just days before that third anniversary, the Associated Press, which frankly I lean on pretty heavily here because they tend to be a fairly straightforward, just the facts, ma'am, sort of news outlet, they offered this headline that left many media critics scratching their heads. Quote, one attack, two interpretations. Biden and Trump both make the January 6 riot a political rallying cry. Yep. Both do. Who knows which of their interpretations of the deadly insurrection, which resulted in the deaths of seven people, is the accurate one? Who knows? The story itself, if anyone bothers to read it, might tell you, but in our social media age, it seems few see much more than just the headlines as they are carefully splashed across their social media, according to some secret algorithm known only to the corporate, usually right-wing owners of the particular social media site. One media outlet hits the mark. The other drops the ball. We seem to be seeing a lot of that of late. Perhaps I should be happy that at least sometimes they are serving the American people as we need them to in what promises to be one of the most consequential election years in American history. No matter which way it ends up going. Just before the end of 2023, our friend and longtime media critic Dan Frumkin asked in one of his must-read Press Watchers newsletter columns, quote, Will our newsroom leaders in the coming year finally realize that what they're doing in terms of political coverage isn't working, and that maybe it's time to try something different? By different, I mean no longer covering the 2024 election as if divisions about basic facts and democratic rule are just so much partisan squabbling. I mean no longer treating it as a race between two equally legitimate contenders, but making it clear in every story that it is an epochal choice between democracy and dictatorship. I mean abandoning the both sides and pox on both your houses reporting style that allows elite journalists to feel like they are above the fray and instead clearly reporting that one party's faults are wildly more dangerous than the others to the free press and to a free country. Frumkin takes a moment to clarify, quote, "I do not mean being partisan or going easy on the Democratic Party, but I do mean giving President Biden credit where credit is due and calling out deceitful Republican talking points rather than adopting right-wing frames." Frumkin continues, "For a long time now, I've been pessimistic about a reset like this anytime soon. I've thought of this as more of a generational project. But the stakes feel so high right at the moment, for obvious reasons, that I think there's a pretty good chance of change before November." It's uncharacteristically optimistic of Dan Frumkin. In fact, he adds, "What I'll be watching for intently in 2024 is which major newsroom will crack first. Will it be the Associated Press, the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post? Because as Trump claims the Republican nomination and advances toward a possible second term, I predict that enormous pressure will build up, not just outside, but within news organizations to more assertively call out the clear and present danger." Now, when Dan Frumkin says crack, I believe he means crack by, you know, tossing out the old traditional, lazy, and I would argue dangerously irresponsible sort of one side says this, but the other side says that reporting that we have seen over the years, which arguably over the past two decades or more has helped bring us to exactly the dangerous hair trigger mess that we seem to be finding ourselves living in today. That's what I think he means by crack, but let's ask him. Joining us now is Dan Frumkin, who served 12 years at the Washington Post, six of them as the columnist for the White House Watch, wildly popular daily column, before he was unceremoniously dismissed for, I think, not being willing to carry out dangerous and dishonest both sides journalism. He went on to write for HuffPost, The Intercept, Nieman Foundation's Media Watchdog Project, and now his own newsletter, Press Watchers, an independent nonprofit organization which he describes as, quote, an intervention for political journalism. Oh, Dan Frumkin, happy new year and welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Oh, Brad, thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
I wanted to start with the with two contrasting pieces from the mainstream corporate outlets, because I think they may sort of help illustrate the ongoing conflict that you describe going on inside of many newsrooms right now, which I'll get to in a moment. you describe it in your near year-end piece headlined, "In 2024, newsrooms will be under intense internal pressure to defend democracy." I want to talk about that conflict and the various sides to it, but do those two stories I cited seem to underscore the conflict and the very different directions that are happening inside of newsrooms that you argue is now underway?
Very, very much so. I mean, the good news, and it is unusual for me to focus on the good news.
Yes, I know.
In the media.
Are you okay?
Is that I think we're seeing two steps forward, one step back. In that, I do see some braver, more honest, more upfront journalism happening on occasion at the major institutions. And then every so often they'll backslide terribly. And that AP story was a disaster. There was a USA Today story that was a disaster. But interestingly enough, I mean, you're seeing the folks at the Washington Post, the New York Times, I think, shift towards a recognition that this election needs to be covered differently. Mm-hmm. That it's not just a question of what happened yesterday and who's up, who's ahead, but you know, it's what NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen calls the stakes, not the odds. Mm-hmm. Really looking at what's going on big picture and focusing on really important issues, like, for instance, the urging of, you know, the encouragement of political violence. Mm-hmm. This is a huge, huge issue, and I'm really happy to see some attention being given to it in a pretty straightforward way.
Yeah, and they went right to it. It was straightforward, and they didn't seem to make excuses for it. But, you know, that AP headline I quoted, one attack, two interpretations, Biden and Trump both make the January 6th riot a political rallying cry, that got a lot of pushback. I guess to AP's credit, it's still being used on their website. They didn't change it, so I guess kudos for at least sticking by their guns. But why is that... Why is that problematic?
The AP is an odd duck. It's a bit schizophrenic. You know, it on the one hand, it is sort of the lingua franca of journalism. It's the main source of news for a lot of small newspapers and mm-hmm. so on. And that actually makes it sometimes a little bit overly cautious about stating things in a way that might seem like they're pro-democratic party. Mm-hmm. So it comes and goes. They're a little bit split that way. Sometimes you'll see very strong AP stories, and sometimes you'll see very weak ones. Yeah. So, and I think that does actually very much reflect the tension that I'm describing going on in other news organizations. There are some folks, mostly not involved in political journalism, who are getting really, really impatient with the way that political journalists are covering things. That they are getting really impatient with this both sidesism and the pox of both your houses stuff. Mm. And if you talk to any journalist who is not personally themselves invested in the old way of doing things, so in other words, not current political reporters, not current political editors, not editors in chiefs of organizations that have had to, you know, that have adopted these policies and defended them vociferously over the years, if you talk to anybody who's not personally invested, any journalist, you'll find that they actually probably agree with this critique. It is not a radical critique anymore. It is very much a how do we do journalism in this day and age question. And I think the answer is increasingly becoming we have to call it out the way we see it, and that we need to stand up for democracy and for free press and for core journalistic values. That doesn't mean telling people to go vote Democratic. It doesn't mean being easy on the Democrats. But it does mean pointing out what this danger is right now.
You talk about that you hear from a lot of journalists on this. You sort of describe two competing sides here. The traditionalists, as you call them, saying that they are still in control, next to a newer, younger, more diverse staff of whose sense of self is defined by more than just not taking sides, but of informing the public of the truth. Talk to me about those two competing factions that you describe as sort of having it out right now. I mean, they are in the newsrooms working together, right?
Right. Well, I don't want to make it sound like it's just the old versus the young.
Okay.
Because I think there's plenty of the olds are also impatient with the current setup. Mm-hmm. You know, here's how I look at it. You look at a daily issue of the New York Times or the Washington Post or AP, and you see extraordinarily good investigative reporting, mm-hmm. powerful international reporting, really thoughtful culture reporting. I mean, you see really great journalism there. So there are people in the newsroom who are really working their butts off doing great journalism. And I think they feel undermined by the he said, she said, you know, you decide coverage of the political journalists. And I hear occasionally from folks in newsrooms, not on the political desks, who feel that way. And I think it's just obvious when you look at how straightforward and just decent journalism is being done by a lot of folks in the newsroom. I know they're frustrated.
Well, it's also frustrating for me when I see something like that from AP, which, as I noted, mm-hmm. You know, I do sort of lean on heavily because there often are just the facts. But, you know, when you see one failure like that headline, mm-hmm. Or you see one failure over the New York Times, it does give people an excuse to say, well, I'm never going to trust that entire outlet again. That's dangerous, but I think that's just sort of the sad fact of where we are these days in our media, with social media, et cetera. It doesn't take much to undermine good journalism elsewhere.
Well, I think what's incumbent upon all readers these days is to be more critical mm-hmm. of the sources, is to read with an eye towards what is being told, what is not being told. And I think that that's true of the New York Times and of any place. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that they've lost trust among most of their readers. I think there's a frustration that they're not telling what they know. Mm. But I think that the issue of losing trust in the media is more a right-wing sort of thing, mm-hmm. because Trump and Fox News have done such a good job of delegitimizing people who actually are trying to tell the truth.
Well, in some sense, and you're right, they have. I mean, those things are sort of used by folks across the board to be skeptical of media outlets, and they should mm-hmm. be skeptical. But you're right, on the right, they've just decided anything that comes from anything that is not one of their approved outlets, not just Fox News, but all the other fake media outlets out there, that anything that does not come from them cannot be trusted. So in one sense, are they a lost cause? And in another sense, does it even matter what goes on at these traditional outlets?
Yeah,
because,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, they're never a lost cause. And I feel like newsroom executives at newsrooms that are fact reality based are making a mistake in suggesting that thinking that they shouldn't confront this misinformation that's coming from Fox and from Trump. Mm-hmm. But I think that major newsrooms should advocate for the truth as powerfully, as emotionally, and as entertainingly as Fox does, mm-hmm. rather than just sitting back and acting like nothing's going on. And then secondly, they ought to really actively rebut what is being said that's not true out in the public sphere.
Well, there is this sense that these outlets think that, oh, if they just, hang on to the old school traditionalist, one side did this, one side did that, then somehow they will win back these people from Fox News. Mm-hmm. That ain't going to happen. But even in the larger picture, Dan Frumkin, does it matter what any of these outlets do? Because doesn't what happens, sadly enough, but doesn't what happens on social media now determine what America actually understands or doesn't understand or misunderstands about their political system? And is there a solution to that? Or frankly, Dan, are we screwed no matter what happens in the old legacy newsrooms at this point?
Well, of course we're screwed, Brad. You know that. But no.
I was hoping you were not going to say that, but all right.
No, the reality is that social media has changed the dynamic enormously. And yet, still, I think legacy media has an extraordinary ability to set the political narratives in a way that social media does sometimes. But mm-hmm. I think legacy media still matters an awful lot. And I think that the reason why I focus so much on the Washington Post and the New York Times and the AP is I think they have enormous influence on the entire legacy media. Mm-hmm. And I do think the legacy media matters. I think that it could be the legacy media could be your local newspaper. The legacy media could be the evening news. I still think they have influence. And I think it's really important for them not to just sort of take a damn the pox of both your houses sort of attitude towards what's going on.
Very quickly, you describe what you call the silent journalistic majority. And I'm going to take that as a good sign, too, because, at least there are a majority, whether they're silent or not right now is a separate issue. But you describe them inside the newsrooms who see their colleagues covering up for Republican failures, saying that, quote, Congress is unable to govern rather than the Republican Party who's running the House. Mm-hmm. Abortion bans are a messaging problem for the party rather than a cruel denial of basic rights. amplifying fake, bad faith Republican scare stories about critical race theory, treating the impeachment inquiry of Joe Biden as if it is not just a ridiculous joke without evidence. So you go on to say that while they used to only be embarrassed by that, now these people inside the newsrooms, these silent journalistic majority, are actually scared. Really? And though I hate to say it, maybe that's a good thing.
Oh, I think it'd be a great thing. I think they should be scared. I don't have, you know, poll results to show you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And some of this is hunches based on, you know, a number of conversations here and there. But I do think that any journalist has reason to be scared on a personal level right now, because if Trump takes power, he's going to go after the media and he will criminalize journalism in a lot of ways. And the free press, as we know it, will be under a lot of pressure. And I don't think any journalist could sit there and say, well, I'll be fine if Trump wins. I think they all should be terrified. And I think they are. I think, like I said, an increasing number are. And you're seeing some of that, for instance, in this story on political violence. I think that's mm-hmm. one of the big issues that was basically kind of swept under the rug until recently. And now you're seeing coverage of that.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see next more coverage of this incredible backlash against LGBTQ plus rights. Mm-hmm. That I think that's a part of what the Republican platform is all about right yep. now.
Well, finally here to sort of underscore one of the problems you describe for, I guess we'll call them team traditionalism, who you note are still in control, by and large, at these newsrooms. You cite Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley, the author of How Fascism Works, in comments that he gave to Salon, noting, quote, if you are just now realizing that Trump is a fascist, you're going to be looking for signs to assuage yourself that you are just being hysterical because you spent so many years calling those of us who have been correctly describing it, correctly describing reality as hysterical. Isn't that sort of it, in one sense, that these people are sort of afraid to admit how badly they have screwed up for so many years, Dan? And this goes beyond, as you know, beyond the Trump years, because, you know, folks like you and I guess me have been warning about heading to the very point that we are now at for years. And if they admit as much now, yep. they're admitting to decades of failure.
That's why I'm not entirely optimistic. Mm-hmm. that's the big fear, is that they will, you know, go down with the ship rather than recognize that they've been steering it in the wrong direction. And that, you know, they've defined themselves by being above, you know, and better than the dirty hippies, you know, who are always screaming about freedom.
Mm-hmm. Freedom, rule of law, democracy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they really see themselves as being superior to those folks and to us folks. And that's why it'll be a tough battle.
Well, it'll be a battle, but as some dirty hippie named Dan Frumkin said, maybe they are cracking. We'll find out. Dirty hippie Dan Frumkin is now the editor of Press Watch, which you can find at presswatchers.org. Please sign up for his newsletter there. He is the creator and editor of the website, which continues to do important work in no more important than in this very, I promise you, insane year. Dan, great speaking with you, my friend. I will be bothering you throughout the year. Plan on it.
Thank you, Brad, and good luck with the other dirty hippies.
Thank you, sir. Working on it. Okay.
You know, I had one quick thing I wanted to add. You know, there are things that, you know, individual people can do to help alleviate this both sides situation. Reach out to your local media, subscribe to your local newspaper, talk to your you know, and engage with your local radio and TV stations, because, you know, it can't hurt, and they should hear from you, because, you know, they're going to hear from people who insist on trying to push them into broadcasting false both sides.
Oh, they're
going to
hear. They'll hear from people on the right, because there is an entire industry meant at haranguing those folks at the media to scare them into what they're doing.
You can help out with that.
But don't contact us. We're good. Actually, I'm bradcast at bradblog.com.
Yes,
all right. As mentioned at the top of the show, it may take a while, but we do have a bunch of accountability stories that we have been, that have been stacking up from before, during, and since the holidays that I want to get caught up on. Some include stories that we have been covering, in fact, going back 10 or 15 years. Yes, the American judicial system can be very slow. But for now, anyway, it appears to still be mostly working. Whole bunch of accountability news is next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. Please help the Bradcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the Bradcast and bradblog.com free for all. We couldn't do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. If anybody's actually breaking any rocks yet, but working on it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So while everyone is sort of wondering if Donald Trump is going to be convicted of a crime and perhaps even end up in jail, really, before this year's November election, there's a whole lot of accountability going on for folks. A whole bunch of folks, frankly, on the Trump MAGA right beyond Trump that I want to make sure we take time to note. We'd hate to have them, you know, we don't want to ignore anybody here.
No, of course not.
We want to make sure everyone gets their due. I will get to them in a moment. But even Trump himself is on the cusp of some very real accountability himself. And very soon, make no mistake, late last week, New York Attorney General Letitia James called for a $370 million fine against the former president and his companies and a lifetime ban, a ban on him and two of his former company executives from the real estate industry entirely in New York. Attorneys from James's office requested the punishment in post-trial motions that were filed on Friday in the New York State Trump fraud case. Difficult to keep them all separated. I do understand. They said that Trump owes $168 million of interest allegedly saved because of his fraud, $152 million from the sale of the old post office building in Washington, D.C. That's the site of the Trump International Hotel in D.C., $60 million through the transfer of the Ferry Point Golf Course contract, and $2.5 million from severance agreements for former Trump Organization officials. James also called for lifetime bans for Trump and those two executives from participation in the real estate industry, as well as from serving as officers or directors in any New York corporations or entities. The AG also asked for 5-year bans for Donald Trump's eldest sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, with the same conditions. So the whole family will be out of New York real estate if the judge moves forward with this request. The summary.
I'm sure so many New Yorkers will be so sad. So sad to see them.
I know, it is sad, isn't it? The summary judgment in the case already, before the trial even began, Trump was already found guilty. It found the former president, his company, top executives, all liable for repeated and persistent fraud in preparing and certifying as true Trump's statements of financial condition, which were falsely inflated by anywhere between $812 million and $2.2 billion year after year after year. The sum that Tish James is now seeking is well over the $370 million, is well over the $250 million she had initially estimated back in 2022 that Trump and his businesses should pay in damages. That, her office explained, due to new information that was gleaned during the trial on damages. And remember, that trial was only on how much and, you know, what the penalties would be. Before the trial even started, the judge determined on summary judgment that, yes, Trump and all of the others were guilty, or at least liable for this fraud. The trial began back in early October with testimony in the case that ended last month. Closing arguments now in this second phase of the trial are set for this week. And last night, several media outlets were reporting that Trump himself was going to give part of those closing arguments. The AG's office objected to that since it would essentially, they argued, be Trump, you know, being allowed to testify in this trial without being able to cross-examine him. That after Trump had promised to testify during the trial, but for some reason, he ended up not doing so, to the surprise of exactly no one. But as of today, anyway, Trump is not going to give those closing remarks. The judge had said he would allow it, but only if Trump agreed to the normal rules for such arguments, including, you know, not using it for a political speech, not attacking the prosecutors or the judges or the witnesses or the judge's staff. But Team Trump decided that that was just unfair. What do you mean we can't attack the judge's staff? So there was a lengthy email back and forth, and on Wednesday, Judge Engoron finally said, well, that's it, you're out. No closing remarks from Trump. After closing remarks, however, the judge's ruling, and I'm guessing it's going to be a huge one. She's asking for $370 million and to bar him for life. So it's probably going to be huge. We'll see. Final ruling will be coming, we believe, later this month. So, yes, some very serious accountability is coming. But as noted, Trump ain't the only one. In fact, in one sense, it kind of seems like a huge portion of the right-wing infrastructure is just sort of beginning to crumble at this point. It does seem to be falling apart. In another Tish James-related fraud case, actually, in New York, at long last on Friday, the longtime terrorist-supporting Wayne LaPierre resigned as leader of the National Rifle Association. He ended his decades-long reign over the far-right gun rights group just days before the start of his civil trial this week in New York. Fox News, which first reported on the resignation, said the 74-year-old cited health reasons for his exit. His exit, which came just like the day before the trial started.
Yes, of course. Not suspicious timing at all.
Health reasons. I hope he's okay. Thoughts and prayers for him, by the way. Anyway, the resignation will take effect the end of January. LaPierre had led the NRA for more than 30 years. He was key in transforming the more than 100-year-old group from a respectable gun safety organization into a gun manufacturing lobbyist group. A far-right gun manufacturing lobbyist group. LaPierre and three other current and former NRA leaders are fending off the lawsuit brought by New York Attorney General Tish James back in 2020, which alleges that they violated nonprofit laws for nonprofit groups and misused millions of dollars of NRA funds to finance lavish lifestyles for themselves. James touted LaPierre's exit as, quote, an important victory. She said in a statement, LaPierre's resignation validates our claims against him, but it will not insulate him from accountability. We look forward to presenting our case in court. After seeing what she did to Trump in his fraud case, I think Tish James means it. The lawsuit alleges LaPierre diverted millions of dollars from the company's from the group's charitable mission for his personal use. As Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal describes, James's office has alleged LaPierre spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in NRA charitable assets on private plane trips for himself and his family, vacations several times in the Bahamas on the yacht of an NRA vendor, accepted other lavish gifts from NRA vendors, and arranged lucrative no-show or little-show financial deals with board members and former executives, among other allegations. And there are a lot of them. Amid the corruption allegations, the NRA's revenues have plunged. Its membership is down and its influence has waned, says the Wall Street Journal. Revenue in 2022 of $211 million sounds like a lot of money, but that was actually down 40% from 2018, while membership dues fell by more than half in that period, and their legal fees skyrocketed.
I wonder I wonder if NRA members realized that they were buying a lavish personal lifestyle for Wayne LaPierre and those executives.
And if they did realize it, do they care? The civil trial begins this week. It's expected to last 6 weeks. If the jurors find the defendants liable, they will recommend the amount of money that each defendant would have to repay the NRA, and whether the defendant should be permanently barred from serving on the board of any charity in New York, and whether an independent monitor should oversee the NRA's finances. The attorney general is seeking both of those remedies, which would be decided on during a second phase of the trial, not unlike the one that Donald Trump, for his part, and his corrupt company is just completing. And then there are these folks, who you may remember, since Trump and the NRA are hardly the only right-wing sleazeballs and grifters who make their dirty livings from grifting their own supporters. These other folks also bilked millions of dollars from, in their case, right-wing millionaires, billionaires, and just ordinary stooges. These folks pretended to be journalists running a journalism outlet, exposing corrupt organizations with corrupt leaders. But in fact, they themselves were a corrupt organization run by a corrupt leader the whole time. Though they did manage to hoax a whole bunch of otherwise legitimate mainstream media outlets into reporting on them as if they were a real news organization for many, many years, despite my very best efforts to warn those legitimate media outlets about these guys, pretty much from day one, including eventually the New York Times, who I was able to finally persuade to issue corrections to a whole bunch of false stories that they ran on this group. Now, if you guessed that I'm talking about right-wing con artist James O'Keefe and his disgraced, now all but completely out of business and ironically named Project Veritas group, well, you have guessed correctly. Via the HuffPost just before the end of the year, what is almost certainly the final death knell for the corrupt O'Keefe's original corrupt propaganda outlet anyway. The chief executive of Project Veritas, a self-identified investigative journalism organization that pushes far-right agendas, announced she is resigning because of, quote, strong evidence of past illegality and past financial improprieties. I am stepping down from all roles with Project Veritas and Project Veritas Action, effective immediately, wrote Hannah Giles on Monday. This would have been Monday before the holiday. She wrote on Twitter, you may remember Giles as the young woman who pretended to be a prostitute in these faked up videos that were originally published by Andrew Breitbart that claimed to show her going into offices of the voting rights and community organization group Acorn to ask for help buying a house. O'Keefe added on opening and closing titles, showing him dressed as a 70s era pimp, which the mostly black workers at Acorn, I guess, were just too stupid to notice that this skinny little 20-year-old kid from New Jersey wasn't really a 70s-era blaxploitation pimp. That was the point of O'Keefe falsely editing those videos to make it look like that. But, of course, it was all a scam. He never dressed as a pimp in Acorn's offices. And the workers there never helped them to smuggle in underage girls into the country for sex trafficking.
It was all a lie.
Yeah. But yet, outlets like the New York Times and, frankly, everyone else were only too happy to echo the nonsense that was in these videos. And that led to the quick downfall of Acorn, which had registered millions of low-income voters to vote, which was really the purpose of the whole scam in the first place, to hurt that group, which, you know, helped democracy and stuff. As Giles continued in her announcement, she said, "Though I had high hopes when I joined the organization, I stepped into an unsalvageable mess, one wrought with strong evidence of past illegality." Back when it was run by O'Keefe, he was pushed out. They brought her in. And past financial improprieties. Once such evidence was discovered, I brought the information to the appropriate law enforcement agencies. Thank you, she added. Giles took over for O'Keefe back in June last year when the group's board uncovered, quote, financial malfeasance by O'Keefe, including, as they detailed it, things like $14,000 on a charter flight to meet someone to fix his boat under the guise of meeting with a donor, $60,000 in losses by putting together dance events, such as the Project Veritas Experience. He is currently himself, O'Keefe, under investigation in New York for misusing Project Veritas funds. I suspect Tish James may have a thought or two on that. In September, the group laid off their employees amid the struggles. Giles and O'Keefe worked together in 2009 on a hidden video sting that purportedly showed employees of Acorn agreeing to aid the pair in crimes. Those videos actually showed no such thing, at least until they were edited to give that impression by O'Keefe. The two, who had been employed by the now late right-wing journalist Andrew Breitbart, ended up paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in settlements to one of the Acorn staffers. The organization, however, lost much of its funding despite investigations. The Acorn organization lost much of its funding despite probes that found no wrongdoing. Last year, Project Veritas was ordered to pay $120,000 to a Democratic consulting firm for secretly recording employees at the firm to embarrass them. In December, it was also reported that a judge has rejected a reporter attorney-client privilege claim by the now defunct Project Veritas in a probe of what appears to be a stolen diary from the daughter of Joe Biden that looks like Project Veritas was involved with in some way. And the judge is allowing investigators to get emails from, between the, O'Keefe and his attorneys, barring some stay or appeal. Now, it would seem they are all but finished. Project Veritas. Of course, O'Keefe has opened up another fraud shop that he calls O'Keefe Media Group, and I suspect he is continuing to bilk right-wingers over there, like the Koch Network, out of millions of dollars, which is just fine by me. Take all the money of theirs you want. We will see if law enforcement officials in New York eventually take the appropriate action against that guy. And finally, just in case it's driving you crazy how long some of these cases actually take to work their way through the legal system. It's not just the cases against, Donald Trump, Giuliani, James O'Keefe, and so forth. This is how the legal system works, particularly when you have a bad faith bunch of lawyers who are willing to stretch things out as long as possible. Washington Post reported just after the turn of the new year, Quote, 8 years after a former Kentucky County clerk refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples in the state, she must now pay $260,000 in fees and expenses to attorneys who represented one of the couples, according to a federal judge. The ruling is separate from a jury's earlier decision that Kim Davis, remember her, must pay $100,000 in damages to the couple. The judge's decision is the latest outcome in litigation that began back in 2015. So now 9 years ago, following the Supreme Court's ruling in Obergefell v. Hodges that same-sex couples have the right to wed as heterosexual couples do. The case took years to settle as Davis appealed many of the earlier decisions. Sound familiar? Her attorneys had argued that the plaintiff's attorney's fees should be reduced by more than half. The U.S. District Judge David Bunning, his ruling said, however, that the rates charged were reasonable, given the plaintiffs prevailed after they sought to vindicate their fundamental right to marry and obtain marriage licenses. Quote, where a plaintiff has obtained excellent results, his attorney should recover a full compensatory fee, Bunning wrote. Liberty Council, a religious freedom organization, so-called, that represented Kim Davis, said Wednesday that it would, of course, appeal the case, including the damages and the attorney's fees. So this still ain't over 9 years later. Quote, on appeal, we will not only request the jury verdict be set aside due to lack of evidence to support a damages claim. We will also argue Kim Davis is protected by the First Amendment freedom of religion clause. That, according to the founder and chair of Liberty Council in a statement. And we will argue that the 2015 case of Obergefell v. Hodges should be overruled. So you see what they're doing here. They are using this case to try to make another run to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
To try to gut, to try to take this right away from all of us the way, you know, they overturned Roe. That's exactly what they're trying to do here. Only two of the original five justices in the Obergefell majority on the Supreme Court remain on the bench. Chief Justice John Roberts filed a strong dissent at the time, along with Alito and Thomas, who, by the way, recently argued in his concurring opinion when overturning Roe v. Wade back in 22 that the Obergefell decision was wrong and it should be reversed. It should be revisited, along with the case that allowed the right of contraception for adults. That's where we're going. Quote, Obergefell is on very thin ice and lacks any legal precedent or foundation, the attorney representing Kim Davis said. So no, this court is not done taking away rights from Americans after they did so in the Dobbs decision that overturned 50 years of reproductive freedoms in Roe v. Wade. If they could overturn that, well, Obergefell, that's only been around for 9 years, right? Why do those gay people get to be married?
Why do those silly ladies get to have birth control?
From the start, Kim Davis has been represented by this group, Liberty Council. They provide free legal assistance for, quote, advancing religious freedom, the sanctity of human life, and the family. I guess religious freedom includes, you know, ignoring the law and the Constitution and so forth.
And the right to discriminate.
Davis issued a statement back in 2015 explaining that her refusal to license a same-sex marriage is, quote, a heaven or hell decision. I'll hold my remarks in response to that. In March of 22, the Judge Bunning ruled that Davis had violated the rights of two couples and that her religious beliefs did not justify her refusal to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples as required by law.
Yeah,
and
I mean, if you won't do the job, then resign from the job. That's a very simple response, seems to me. But well, no, she wanted to make a big spectacle of it, and she's got her spectacle, and we'll see if she ends up actually paying any damages.
Well, let's see. $100,000 she owes the couple. $260,000 now she owes the attorneys. If they're going to continue to appeal, I guess she could be held liable for much more down the road, whether she'll pay it or one of these right-wing millionaires and billionaires will come in and help her out with it. Well, that remains to be seen. In the meantime, as I have been talking over the last few minutes, some breaking news. Let's see. Let me go with whose is this? This is NBC's version. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie plans to suspend his long-shot presidential campaign, according to two sources who have knowledge of the campaign and its plans. Christie is not expected to make any endorsement at this time, according to one of the sources who speculated that Christie may want to wait until after the Iowa caucus next Monday before making any announcement in order to amplify its effect. So just as we talked about on yesterday's program, when we were talking about Nikki Haley's surge in the polls, and that a couple of polls have her within single digits now of Donald Trump in New Hampshire. I had been sort of critical yesterday and in previous days of Chris Christie that if he really wants Donald Trump to lose, if he's really concerned that Donald Trump is a danger to this nation, well, there's basically two ways to do something about it. Either you get behind Joe Biden, which I don't expect Chris Christie to do, or you get behind Nikki Haley, who actually could. We'll see. But according to a couple of these polls, actually could at least make a run at Donald Trump in New Hampshire, which is in about 2 weeks' time, the first of the nation primary, which is then followed by South Carolina, which is Nikki Haley's state.
Yes. So, and so and he has, Christie has enough supporters that if they were all to switch to Haley, I believe that she would then surpass Trump in New Hampshire, at least in the polls.
Yeah, some of the polls suggest that something like 7 out of 10 of his supporters would, in fact, move to Haley if, in fact, he called on them to do so.
Which is not clear if he's going to do that.
I bet he will. But we'll see.
We'll see.
All right, we got to get out. My thanks again to Dan Frumkin of PressWatchers.org. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's program, you want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can download it anytime for free at BradBlog.com. That is free. No right-wing billionaires needed to listen to the Bradcast. You can also, that is thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate or just hit any of the donate buttons at bradblog.com. You help us stay on the air, not Charles Koch or whichever one of them is still living. You can drop me an email on bradcast@bradblog.com, and you will find me on, yes, social media, on the Facebooks, the Mastodons, and the site still known as Twitter at TheBradBlog. See you there till we see you here tomorrow with special coverage of whatever the hell happens in Iowa. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.